Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'm going to continue talking about the precepts, and this morning I would like to talk about some of the things that Suzuki Roshi had to say about the precepts. So I think everybody knows, here knows who Suzuki Roshi is, but I'll just say Suzuki Roshi came to the United States. Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, Japanese priest, Soto Zen, came to the United States in 1959 as a missionary, the head of temple, the abbot of the temple of Sokoji, which is in San Francisco, to minister to the Japanese Americans. And then some hippies started sitting with him.
Exactly.
Adrian, were you actually there?
I wasn't there then, but that's what happened. Yeah. I heard about it.
So some hippies started to sit with him, and it just sort of cascaded from there and turned into San Francisco Zen Center eventually. I think they bought the building in 1968, maybe, at City Center, which used to be a home for single Jewish women. Anyway, so I wanted to talk about what Suzuki Roshi had to say about the precepts. And before I start that, I just thought I'd say what the meaning of the word precepts is. I looked it up in the dictionary. The basic meaning in English is a general rule intended to regulate behavior or thought. So that's kind of the meaning of precept. And that comes from the Latin, pre, of course, means before. And then sept part is to take, to warn or to instruct. To take, to warn, or to instruct. So it's kind of interesting just to sort of, especially in view of what Suzuki Roshi has to say. So just to kind of put that in the hopper. And then in Sanskrit, the word that I found that was maybe closest to precept is called samvara, S-A-M-V-A-R-A. And basically it means to restrain. So there's that quality of restraint. Again, keep that in mind. In the Mahayana, it refers to kind of rules of behavior. It refers to three things: rules of behavior, the vow to do good, and to be engaged with the welfare for others, other people's welfare. But the esoteric meaning of this word, samvara, is unity. So again, that's just keep that in mind. Okay, Suzuki Roshi. I have to tell you that I have edited and kind of cleaned up the English in these talks because some of them are really early, and so there the English is a little difficult to follow. Okay, so the first one I want to read, I've titled Seeing Things As It Is Versus Seeing Things As I Want Them to Be. So here's what he said. He said, in our way of Zen, we emphasize the way-seeking mind, the bodhisattva mind. So this is this mind of bodhicitta. This is usually seen as a kind of, often talked about as the awakening of bodhicitta, so this desire to practice. So he says, in our way of Zen, we emphasize the way-seeking mind, the bodhisattva mind. We say, observe things as they are. And then he says, I found out that there is a big misunderstanding in your understanding of observe things as they are. We often say, some of us will say, things just as they are. So he said, I found out that there's a big misunderstanding in your understanding of observe things as they are. In your philosophy, there are two ways, things as it is and things as they should be. So this is the kind of juxtaposing he's doing. But things do not exist as they should be. If you do not observe things as it is, you observe things as your own way. So when we say to observe things as it is, means to you to see things as they should be. So are you following what he's saying here? And then he has a big laugh about it. Do you understand? For you, as it should be, means it is not so, but it should be so. You want to be religious. You want to be moral. You think we should be more moral or we should be more religious. This is the way it should be. This means that you are religious or moral, but for a bodhisattva, things as it is morality. Things as it is morality. Responding with a way-seeking mind, it is not about choosing one of the two, good or bad. We do this not from a moral viewpoint, but from a bodhisattva's viewpoint. When we take a bodhisattva's viewpoint, there is no alternative way. We choose good and we refrain from evil. But if you have no way-seeking mind, or if you have no idea of the bodhisattva way, you will wonder which way to choose. Okay, so let's talk about this for a second. So there's things just as they are, and then there's this idea of things the way we want them to be. So I think, you know, what he's saying here is that often when we hear the precepts, so the precepts are, you know, don't kill, do not kill, for example. Another way to say that precept is, in the mind of the bodhisattva, there is no killing. So in the mind of the bodhisattva would never think to do something that was going to be unskillful in a way that we would say to kill something. So again, this is kind of a koan, like what it means to say, do not kill. So Suzuki Roshi is saying, if we say to observe things as they are, so this is a phrase that refers to, for example, everything is in an interconnected relationship. We can talk about it that way. We say things just, he said, things just as it is, not things just as they are, things just as it is. So to use the singular verb is instead of are, to use the singular of that, is the sense of things just as it is the duality of things and the oneness of is. So this way in which he's holding in that, this way in which there's the form realm in which we perceive things as separate, and yet the reality of that realm is that it's all one. Right? Again, I think Jaku's going to talk, she's going to talk today during the precepts class about Buddha nature, and so this will come up probably in that discussion about, because what we're talking about here is things just as it is also, we could say, is Buddha nature. So it's not that we are trying to return to this oneness because we are already this oneness, but we perceive things as being separate and singular. So things just as it is. So how do we see the world in that way? So that's what the precepts are about, is this way of perceiving the world. Suzuki Roshi is saying the problem for us is that we say to ourselves, not things as they are, but we say things as they should be. So then we get into this realm of becoming rigid about the precepts, taking them as a kind of Ten Commandments being brought down from the mountain and saying in this very rigid way what they are. So when we do that, we can't actually discern the wise course of action because we're not including the totality of what's happening, right? So in this way, the precepts might seem to be very loose, very flexible, in the sense that they're not rigid, they're not you should. They're not about us making the world into some preconceived idea that we have about what it means to say precept, what it means to say this precept. So remember, we talked about samvara also meaning unity. So this word in Sanskrit, this esoteric meaning of unity. So what we're interested in is this bodhisattva way, which is a kind of unity as opposed to this very restrictive way of looking at things. So he says, responding with a way-seeking mind, this bodhisattva mind, is not about saying something's good or bad. I think we can say, we can ask ourselves, like a koan, is this skillful? Is this helpful? You know, what's happening here? These words, good and bad, have such deep connotations of right and wrong and very moralistic. So he's saying this is not that kind of rigid moralism. But he also says, when we take the bodhisattva's viewpoint, there's no alternative way. So what he's pointing to is this mind of the bodhisattva. When we are able to ground ourselves in things just as they are, things just as they is, reality as it is, a situation as it is, a person as they are, when we can ground ourselves in that and actually ask, what's the most skillful thing to do here, rather than what do I think should be the right thing to do here, but what is the most helpful thing to do here. This is this way, he says. This is the bodhisattva way. This is the bodhisattva mind. So he says, we choose good and refrain from bad, but if you do not have a way-seeking mind, or if you have no idea of this bodhisattva way, you have no kind of framework to put this in, you will wonder which thing to choose. So we talk about, in Buddhism, we talk about no self, no inherently existing self. So that no inherently existing self, or big mind, or Buddha nature, this self is the altruistic self. The self is the self that's inclusive. And then we talk about the small self. So this is the self that says, you know, it's just about me. You know, I'm the center of the circle. What is, you know, what do I think the small mind of myself want in this situation? And that's the mind of should. That's the mind of the morality of should. So my kind of go-to story about this is, I understand that when Christian missionaries went to Hawaii, they decided that the people who lived there weren't wearing enough clothes. And so they had them wear, I guess, what we now call muumuus, right? They wore these big, voluminous outfits. And people got sick. They got really sick. Was it typhoid?
There was some smallpox.
Smallpox. So people got smallpox, and it wiped out thousands of people. So here's a way in which this is this kind of morality or should of, here's the precept, which is people should wear more clothes. They should have a lot of clothes on because that's the moral, modest thing to do. So we bring this culture into a different culture, into a different situation with a rigid view, and it's very harmful. So there's a kind of cautionary tale about this, what Suzuki Roshi is pointing to here. Okay, so another quote here is attachment to being pure. So it's kind of along the same lines. Dogen Zenji said, don't be attached to purity or impurity. Don't be attached to the idea that if there is no evil here, you are pure. Don't be attached to the state of mind you think has purity. And even though you are not pure, don't try to escape from it. If you try to escape from it, it means you are attached to purity. Your small ego is working still. Your small ego is trying to push out the evil thought. So still, you are occupied by small ego as long as you are trying to get out of it. You should not try to make some tentative particular effort based on your small mind, like, my practice should be better. My practice, you say, but Zazen is not your practice. It is Buddha's practice. So before we go to that paragraph, this first one, again, this idea of being attached to things being pure or impure. So in our minds, I think, again, we get caught in this notion of making up a standard. In Zen, we say, you know, don't make up standards on your own. Don't make up standards on your own. So we come to practice or we come to a situation and we're trying to do something good, but we already have this preconceived notion about what that is. So we say, well, that's pure. That's a pure response. That's the good thing to do. And we want to avoid being what we have, what Suzuki Roshi is calling impure here. So this juxtaposition between these opposites of purity and impurity. That's not the language that I would use to describe this, but I think it gets to this kind of very, again, this very rigid prescribed notion that we have about what is pure and what is impure. And this controlling way in which we try to steer things based on our preconceived ideas of what those are. So he says, he's quoting Dogen here, he says, don't be attached to the idea, again, if there's no evil, you are pure. So I think this points to something interesting about ourselves that he's trying to say here, that we tend to say, well, if there's, this is this very black and white kind of thinking, we can get caught in this very moralistic way of, well, I'm right. I know what the right way is. And the way I interpret this in kind of our kind of language, or my kind of language, would be something like, we might say to ourselves, this person is doing something, but I would never do that thing. Right? So you might look at somebody and say, oh, you know, they sold something, and I would never do that. So this I would never do that is this flip side of they're impure and I'm pure. But the reality is that you might not do this particular thing, but on the other hand, you're probably doing something else that's unskillful. So you might not be somebody who runs around slandering other people, so that would be very unskillful, but you might be somebody who, I don't know, gets greedy about something. You might be somebody who has greed issues. So there's this way that really none of us are pure. So whenever we get into this state of mind where we have some language to ourselves about, well, I'm really right, or I know better, or I would never do that, or something like that, that there usually it's a comparison. And the other side of that comparison is somebody else is doing something that's wrong. So this way in which we really want to be careful about that and not get caught in those kinds of comparisons. If we acknowledge, and I think this is the second part of this, so he says, don't be attached to the state of mind you think has purity. So don't be attached to what you think is the rigid right way to do this. And even though you are not pure, don't try to escape from it. So this is this part of us where, and I'm sure Suzuki Roshi probably heard when he was talking about the precepts, his students probably came to him and said, oh, you know, and he mentions this in another lecture, which I don't have here. Students come in the precepts ceremony. You say, yes, I will. Yes, I will. You know, will you follow the precepts? Yes, I will. And students come and say, well, I can't say yes, I will, because I'm not good enough to say yes, I will, because I know that I'm going to break the precepts all the time. How can I say yes, I will with enthusiasm? Because I know that I'll fail, right? I think this might be really American, very Western idea. So we're very black and white in that way. Oh, I can't say that. That would be wrong. That would be not honest, right? So he's saying and even though you are not pure, don't try to escape from it. So in a way, to say, I can't say yes, I will, is trying to escape from the state of being a human being, right? As human beings, we make mistakes. We're unskillful. Maybe other beings do the same thing, but we don't have to worry about them, just have to worry about what we're up to. So he's saying, don't get so black and white about this, that we're going to make mistakes. And he says, when we are attached to that, when we try to escape from that, he says, your small ego is working still. So this criticism of self and criticism of others, because it is a kind of criticism of self, or rigidity about the nature of our practice, it's a kind of almost a near enemy to our deepest sincere desire. Our deepest sincere desire, I think, is to really follow the Bodhisattva way. We really want to do the practice. We want to make this sincere effort. But to say I can't say yes I will because I might fail, I think that's a near enemy to that sincere effort that we make. So he says, your small ego is working still. Your small ego is trying to push out evil thoughts. Again, I think, you know, we try to push away some thing about ourselves that we don't want, we don't like. You know, we don't like about ourselves, so we don't want to see it. And the evil thought, I like this because I noticed in my own mind, you know those little thoughts that go by really fast?
Yeah.
You know, those little, well, those little thoughts are like big, big, big thoughts. Because the ones that go by, like, I don't want to, or I don't like that. Or, I'm not like that. Those quickie little thoughts like that, those are the ones that we want to get rid of and we don't pay attention to. But they will be heard, you know. They will find their space to come out. So it's interesting to pay attention to those little thoughts that go by. When we're sitting Zazen, we often say, people say, well, oh, I don't sit well because I'm thinking. Ujjayi Maharishi says, you ought to think of thoughts like mind secretions. It's just a chemical event that's going on, and that's how it is. We just have these secretions, so, okay. Suzuki Roshi says, he said, don't invite your thoughts to tea, which we do all the time. Hey, come on in, sit down. Here, what, you know, can I, coffee, cream, sugar, you know, let's, oh, here we go, on the drain. Off we go, right? 15 minutes later, we wake up, oh, wow. I just lived my whole life, you know, in the last 15 minutes. I've, you know, Godzilla has chased me down the street. I'm in a complete panic. Oh, thank goodness. I'm just in the Zendo. So these ways that we just get completely caught up in our thinking. It's amazing the power that they have. But, you know, that's just what it is. That's just what it is. We don't have to get freaked out about it or discourage ourselves, because that's what we do. We say, oh, I can't sit Zazen because I think too much. Or, that's very discouraging if you say that. Just accept it. That's things as it is. It's another way to think about things as they are, you know, not as they should be. It's just the state. That's what it's like that day, that morning, that, you know, that period of Zazen. And the next one might be totally different. Probably will be. So, he says, don't try to push out your evil thoughts. And if you do, that's still being occupied by the small ego. I would say something like small mind. Ego in English is kind of a loaded word. But this mind that isn't very generous. We're not being very generous with ourselves. So he says, as long as you're trying to get out of it, get away from it, push it away. So, you know, the three kinds of suffering in the Four Noble Truths are wanting things to be a certain way, not wanting them to be a certain way, and then the kind of rigid or way that we keep reinventing ourselves in this kind of attached way that brings about suffering. So I think this kind of addresses all three of those in relationship to the precepts, right? The precepts are not about, the motivation behind them is not about feeling good about yourself, as like I'm a good person and patting yourself on the back. They're not about beating yourself up, I'm a bad person, and I don't know, hitting yourself in the head. And it's not about reifying some notion of who you are. That's not the underlying idea of what the precepts are about. So he says you should not try to make some tentative particular effort based on your small mind, like my practice should be better. My practice, you say. But then he says, Zazen is not your practice. It is Buddha's practice. So our practice is our practice, and it's not our practice. Our practice is about a kind of trust and faith. It's about refuge. We say, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. That refuge is letting go of our preconceived ideas. That refuge is sitting in the midst of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, sitting in the midst of conflict, disappointment, all of the things that come up for us, greed, hate, delusion, good, evil, great days, bad days, all of those things, just sitting with it and having faith in this Buddha, because we are Buddha. So when we say, when he says it is Buddha's practice, this Buddha is, yes, it's Shakyamuni Buddha, it's every wonderful bodhisattva out there, it's all beings with me, sitting with me, continuous practice, sitting with you in continuous practice. It's us as Sangha being together. It's our big mind. It's the big mind of the universe, letting that come forward. There's something about our big minds that, no matter the fact that they are things just as they are, it's difficult for that to come forward when there's a lot of static going on in our heads. The other day I was sitting Zazen. I mean, literally, like 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago, I was sitting Zazen and I was thinking about something. And I noticed that when I'm thinking, everything else is gone. It's truly amazing. I don't know why I hadn't had this thought before, this insight before. I've been sitting for many, many years. I don't know why this insight hadn't occurred to me before, but suddenly I realized how that it's just like right here, you know. I couldn't hear the traffic. I couldn't hear anything else that was going on. I was completely absorbed in this. So big mind needs some space. Big mind needs a little quiet. Big mind needs a little gap in there to be able to come in and make itself aware to us, ourselves aware to ourselves. Zazen doing Zazen, Buddha doing Zazen with us, this Buddha, this big mind, but it's also the whole universe simultaneously. So he's saying, if we say my practice, or if we're talking about precepts here, like my practice of the precepts, then that becomes very narrow again. There needs to be a kind of spaciousness in this, our approach to how we approach this. He says, your effort is based on big mind. So our effort, we want our effort to be based on this larger perspective, on this space, spaciousness. If your small self begins, I'm reading again, if your small self begins to act without the care of big mind, it is not Zen. Our practice should be based on original way-seeking mind, which works on and on continuously. I'm not sure I don't think he said if your small self begins to act without the care of big mind, it's not Zen. Well, sometimes our small self is acting away, you know, and that's still Zen. We're still practicing. And he talks about this later. I don't know if I have time to talk about all of these. I can always come back and do this another day. But this way in which he's trying to say we want to let the small self, in some ways, let the small self be the small self. Don't take it too seriously. And out of that, big mind will come forward if we don't get too caught in this anxiety, fear. There were chipmunks or something up at Tassajara on the hillside. And so they lived up in little mounds or whatever on the side of the hill. And they would come out, and all they go like, hee, 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 like this, and they'd all be like, be 15 of them out there, and they'd all be like this. So that's, you know, a kind of metaphor for our small mind. The small mind's like, you know, pay attention, say, it's okay, relax, you know, it's all right. Can I, you know, get you a snack? Breathe. And this way that we just kind of calm ourselves down, just say, it's all right. And let our big minds come forward in that moment. Okay. I'll do one more of these quotes. This one I call failing to follow the precepts perfectly is human. Suzuki Roshi said, you may think these precepts are useless if we cannot observe them perfectly. But they are the traces of human efforts based on the great mercy of Buddha. The life we now have now is the result of such useless effort. From one-celled animals to monkeys, I do not know how long, but we wasted much time and many efforts until we came to this human life. The giant redwood trees of mere woods have annual rings or layers, and we have these annual layers in our human life too, I think. That is precepts in its wide sense. As long as you live, you should sit, and thus you will know how to continue your effort to have another annual ring. In this way, we will develop Buddhism more and more forever. So this notion that you may think these precepts are useless if you cannot observe them perfectly, we do that kind of thinking all the time. You know, it's like, oh, I failed at this thing, and so all of my effort is useless. I've quoted Dogen before in this. He talks about shooting the arrow at the target 100 times. And we shoot the arrow, and we miss the arrow, and then the arrow goes right smack in the middle of the target. And he says, you know, all the missed arrows are just as important as the one that hit the target. So we have to make this effort to be skillful. We make our best effort to be skillful. This is our practice. Sometimes we know we're skillful. Sometimes we don't know we're skillful. Sometimes we're unskillful. Sometimes we don't know we're unskillful. Sometimes we have a rule about being skillful and we fail. Sometimes we have a rule and we make it. You can think of all the permutations you could possibly think of about this thing, about it being useless or not. But it's not useless. Every sincere effort that we make is important. So you may think these precepts are useless if we cannot observe them perfectly, but they are the traces of human efforts based on the great mercy of Buddha. In our school, in our teaching, there is this way in which we understand the activity of human beings, the activity of all beings, like a circle. So we have a lineage circle that's vertical. For the people who take the precepts, you get a Kechimyaku, which is the bloodline of the Buddha. And it's a linear bloodline. It starts with Shakyamuni Buddha, and it goes all the way through down to your name. A linear bloodline. There's also a bloodline, though, that's circular. There is this way in which all the efforts of the sixth patriarch are right here with you. All the efforts of Shakyamuni Buddha are still with us. All the efforts of Wei Ning are still with us. Any ancestor you can name, all the ancestors you cannot name, that you do not know about, all of these efforts, all the human beings and the trees and the animals and every effort that has ever been made, successful or not, that sincere effort is still with us today. That sincere effort is the foundation of our practice. So he says, but they are the traces of human efforts based on the great mercy of Buddha. The life we have now is the result of such useless effort. It's a very Japanese, by the way, The life we have now is based on this such useless effort. The useless effort of all the ancestors. And here we are, somehow. So, and I like that part about the one-celled animals to the monkeys, and don't know how long, but we've wasted a lot of time and many efforts, and somehow we're here, despite all of our wasted effort and time. And this idea about these annual rings, right? This is this growth of the tree. What do we see in the annual rings, you know? Somebody who knows trees, they can look at that and say, oh, there was a fire that year. Oh, there was a drought that year. Oh, that was a really great year for redwood trees. Or I can, not just redwood trees, I can actually say this is the particular epoch and it's got this name and this happened then. And we have those rings too in our own lives, right? If we had rings like trees do, and we could cut through a cross section, you know, we could say, oh yeah, that was a great year. You know, I had really good health. Or, oh, that's a year that wasn't such a good year. Or, this is the year my dad died, or this is the year I went to college, or this is my first time I fell in love, or it's the first time that I broke up, or whatever it is, you know, that we have that. And our effort, these precepts, because precepts are essentially a guidepost for our effort. They're just a koan for our effort. What is it? What is it? What is it, my effort? So we build these rings, and this makes up our lives. And we become like we are, like we're like the redwood trees. We are these sturdy trees. And that sap that runs up and down through this tree is our sincere effort. It makes us strong. It's the sincere effort of our own effort and the effort of all the Buddhas. It is our refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, together, doing this thing. Okay, so those are some words of wisdom from our founder, Suzuki Roshi. Thank you very much.